Hello, good morning, and welcome. It's Friday, the 25th of September, 2020, and we're back with episode 161. And yes, I am hoping to get back to my usual twice per week episode run very, very soon. Anyway, today's episode, really great stuff. Frustratingly, I was able to actually record it several weeks ago, so I'm sorry I've not had a chance to publish it until right now. Anyway, we've got Andreas Hermann and Maximilian Richter. They are researchers with the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland, and they've just finished a multi-year study with BCG. It's sort of a sequel to a study that I've talked about quite a bit in the past. If you remember, BCG and the World Economic Forum had done a study on the city of Boston investigating an autonomous future without any sort of car sharing. Spoiler alert, it doesn't work and traffic spikes. Anyway, so this particular study then is trying to understand, kind of classify cities around the world into five different types in an effort to understand which future mobility solution is the best for each city type. Obviously, there isn't sort of one shoe fits all. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking and let them do all the talking because episode 161 with Andreas Hermann and Maximilian Richter begins now. So Andreas and Maximilian, really great to chat with both of you. Max, you and I, of course, had the chance to connect a while back. And actually, if people don't know, if Max's name sounds at all familiar, it's because you will have seen him on our website. He's one of our associates at Hogan & Co. And obviously, guys, it's really exciting to be here today to chat with you. I think it makes sense to kick off with a brief intro from each of you, so we can kind of frame the context. And for me, all I'll say is this is a really, really awesome conversation for me to have because I remember several years ago when I read of the first study that BCG had done regarding the impact on urban traffic by autonomous vehicles in the absence of car sharing. The study, I believe, was conducted in Boston. There was a marked uptake in traffic congestion generally. In fact, that's a study that I've discussed quite a bit on the podcast. So to be able to chat with both of you now and kind of get, shall we say, the sequel to that study, as it were, super, super exciting for me. So please, I guess, Andreas, why don't we kick it off with you if you would give us a brief intro, please, of your background and how you ended up here.
Yeah, I'm a professor at the University of St. Gallen and director of the Center for Customer Insight. We are involved in various projects, mainly with the automotive industry. And that's the reason why we ran into this topic of autonomous driving a couple of years ago. So we did many joint research projects with the auto industry, tried to investigate how people perceive autonomous driving, how it is considered, where are the hurdles, where are the advantages as seen by the consumers. And at some point in time, we got in touch with BCG, and then we decided to do this large-scale empirical investigation about the usefulness of autonomous technology in various city settings.
And so Max, how did you loop into all of this?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Nice that we got the chance to talk today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I, being a PhD student for the last 3 years here at the Institute and worked together with Andreas on the BCG study, and I was really blessed to drive the topic due to the last 1.5 years together with BCG. And my dissertation is mainly in the field of autonomous driving and how autonomous cars can benefit to our future cities. So that's mainly the core topic of me. And yeah, I basically spent the last 3 years working on that topic.
No, it sounds great. So why don't we do this? Why don't we just kick it off with like a high level kind of summary, I guess. I mean, can you sort of clarify, am I correct that this is indeed a sort of sequel to that first study? And if so, what's the difference in the focus, would you say?
Well, the idea of this study was to extend the scope of investigation when it comes to implementing autonomous mobility. We started with the assumption that there are very different cities out there, and not every city is ideal for bringing autonomous vehicles on the streets. And so we try to find a couple of criteria to helping us understanding which type of city is kind of natural for bringing autonomous mobility to the streets. And by doing so, we considered 38 different cities, and we took two handfuls of criteria, and then we ran basically a cluster analysis and found different types of cities. We came up with a handful of types of different cities, and were able to come up with recommendations concerning the implementation of autonomous mobility for those different clusters. That was the idea, to end up with implications for policymakers, for car manufacturers, for tech companies, and help them developing a roadmap for implementing autonomous mobilities in various city contexts.
And got it. So basically the idea is that obviously one solution for one type of city is obviously not going to work for different types of cities based on anything from topography to urban design and so forth. And so Max, you sent me actually the BCG PDF on this. So I see that you've got sort of, you've divided this into five different city types. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So the hypothesis behind it is that every city is unique in its traits. I mean, every city got its own history, own size, and own population. So which makes different form of transportation more suitable for any given city. At the end, that means the impact of an integration of autonomous vehicle will be different in each city. Mm-hmm. But somehow that's our approach, cities are comparable. I mean, Berlin is quite similar as an example to Vienna or Prague. I mean, they have the same amount of modal split, same size or population. So we came up with the idea to cluster them. So we took 44 cities around the world and took all the information we could get about these cities. And then we put them into a tool and came up with the best number of five different archetypes, which represent the cities which are clustered. And the idea behind it, that every city in the world can actually find itself anywhere within this five archetypes, which means even we started from 44 cities, every city can be use this findings we have to bring their strategy of politics according to autonomous driving on the road.
Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity, as an aside, are there any types of city designs that are sort of outliers? Meaning, are there any cities that, for whatever reason, are essentially an impossible candidate for a car shared or autonomous
shared? For sure. I mean, we had in the beginning the I wouldn't say trouble, but we collected the 44 cities and we had to neglect cities from, as an example, Africa, because they are not really suitable, because at some places they don't really have the roads and the conditions for autonomous driving. And also we focused on big cities which are larger than 500 inhabitants. So yes, there are is or are some outliers where we could find.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Got it. And just looking at the simulation result, it looks almost like a scatter plot. So can you, I guess, as best as possible, I guess, sort of verbally describe. So what exactly are we looking at here for the simulation result for each of these five categories of cities? Because each has a remarkably different scatter plot design. Is this representing sort of density of utilization in those city types?
Yes, it is. So what we did is we went to Google Maps and just had tried to get an impression where the most density is inside the city. And we distinguish it by if it is an industry part or if it is like a huge population area or if there's an airport. So there are all information we took in, and then we clustered these cities and came up with this urban structure types. So as an example, to go to the prosperous innovation centers, you see there are a lot of satellites around the main core, like these dots around. So these are cities which have like really big urban places around the core center, as an example. Mm-hmm.
And so is the study, by the way, I should ask, is this PDF something that we can share publicly or not?
Yes, we have put together a report, and this report covers the most important findings, and we can send out this report, yes. So we have it online as a printed version.
But I mean, Max, is this the same one that you just sent to me by email? Is this something that we can share through our website or no?
I mean, it's public.
Oh, it is.
Okay, perfect. So it's distributed by the website of DCG and also by our institute. So that's nothing we want to hide from.
Yeah, perfect. No, the only reason I was asking is because it would be great if people are listening to this podcast to be able to see the actual chart, this graph that we're talking about. Okay, so I guess my next question, I'm just curious. So is the study based? What are the elements or the variables that are affecting the study that you looked at? So, for example, is it primarily the is it everything from like the actual urban design itself to the types of vehicles currently in use? What kind of assumptions are made? And crucially, are there any what impact, if any, was taken into account for the study with respect to, shall we say, consumer acceptance or social acceptance, if it was necessary to implement some sort of personality shift, meaning, for instance, in LA, Max, as you know very well, since you lived in Long Beach anyway, people love their cars. They love to drive individually. So I would assume that this would have some adverse impact on the uptake of, certainly on car sharing, and therefore potentially on, any sort of car sharing, autonomous or otherwise. So is that a factor that was considered, or is it strictly a physical infrastructure study?
So actually, we have a lot of data which is going into the study. As an example, city age, density, and also the mode distribution. We talk about the model mix. But we mainly focused on data which we could find about the city. And what you are talking about is the acceptance of the people, if they would use the mode or not. But we have some graph or like a statistic inside of it, which is about the distribution of when a person will use any transport modes. As an example, if you go for a distance of 2 kilometers, the likelihood that you walk is higher than the distance of 10 to 15 kilometers. So that is a distribution we took from actual literature out there. But to be honest, this is just one tiny part of a dozen of input data we used.
Mark, you're raising a very important point. It will be a very rough right all the way to autonomous mobility, because people love cars. Some people give names to their cars, and the automotive industry did a great job in the past by relating specific emotions to car-based mobility. That's absolutely right. And so basically we need to step back and say, okay, we have different driving situations. It's not fun on a Monday morning to commute between your home outside LA and your office downtown LA. That had nothing to do with happiness, with freedom, or any other emotion. So it's pure burden. And for those occasions, we need to think about improving mobility by using autonomous mobility. But there are other circumstances. On a Saturday night, when you open the roof of your cabriolet and you enjoy riding. And I think we have to consider both situations. And I think both situations will find a place in our modern world. But in this study, we were focusing on the downside of mobility. So when mobility is a burden.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, so I guess the question becomes, I mean, just to close the loop on this aspect anyway, the emotional connection to cars. Mm-hmm. So I've often suggested in the past that you're probably not going to get rid of that emotional bond until a car actually loses the steering wheel. Because only once a vehicle does not have a steering wheel does it stop being a car, and it's basically just a train, mm-hmm. and therefore an appliance.
Yes. Look, if you take, for example, the luxury models from BMW or Audi, these models already today offer L3 autonomous mobility. That means up to a speed of 60 kilometers per hour, you can give up the driving task from the human. To the machine, from you, I can move it from the human to the machine, and we can even go a step further to the next level to L4, where in almost all controlled driving situations, the machine can take over control. But the steering wheel is still in the car, and so you can make a decision. In some situations, when you have this stop and go traffic situations, you give up. Control of the car, or in other situation when you have a free freeway in front of you, you might enjoy driving, and then you take over control. So I do see room for both. I do not see a necessary contradiction.
Well, I'm sort of a contradiction myself because I love driving, and yet we have a Tesla Model Y, and even my wife has said to me on numerous occasions. She says, I cannot believe that you choose to use autopilot as much as you do because you like driving. I said, yes, I like driving on a mountain road, in a canyon, on a racetrack. I don't want to drive on the freeway. So, maybe it's not such a contradiction after all. Okay, neat. Please.
Let's challenge it. Do you really love or like to ride your car in a city like New York or Berlin, where you have an average speed of about, let's say, 20 kilometers an hour, what is about 10 miles per hour. Do you really like that? And
no, that's my point.
In congestion for hours?
Yeah, no, that's my point. I do not like that. The sort of driving that I like is indeed a mountain road, you know, like a beautiful mountain road, yeah, you know, something which indeed doesn't require sitting in traffic and is actually engaging and is fun. So yes, agreed. Ordinary commuting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, commuting is the most time you sit in the car. And
exactly.
So we need to challenge this. Is that really the type of mode you want to choose in the future for commuting the car, which is obviously pretty slow and a lot of traffic jam including?
Well, I mean, I guess if your question is, what do I hope for? I mean, I think it'll still be a car in the sense that it's going to be the box with wheels. But to your point, yeah, of course, absolutely. It should be fully, you shouldn't have to drive. It should indeed be at least level 4, if not level 5, right?
Yeah.
But actually, that's a perfect segue, though, to a question I wanted to ask. So I've been saying for a very long time that I don't even think it's necessary to prioritize. I mean, of course, there should be research on level 5, if only for research sake, and to eventually reach that end game. But I think as a practical go-to market strategy, level 4 is where the focus should be. Because after all, if you have cars which can drive on certain roads and certain lanes and certain conditions from A to B, that would actually be a hugely sufficient win. No, so actually, I guess my question I want to ask you is, does your study consider only fully level 5, or is this considering, for instance, level 4 as well?
No, we considered level 5 because we see basically two entry points into the world of autonomous mobility. One entry point is what technology companies are doing. They jump directly to level 5. That's Mobileye cars, Navya cars, Google cars, and we believe that we will see those vehicles in the inner parts of cities. In inner cities, that's one way. The other way, the other entry point is pursued by the car manufacturers. They go all the way from level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4,
right.
And we will see those technologies probably on freeways. So where people decide, do I want to drive by myself or do I want to take over driving responsibility to the machine? And we considered in this study the situation in inner cities, in these metropolitan areas, where we believe that level 5 will be the solution. These are pods, these are shuttles offered by the city or some other companies. People do not own those vehicles, and they just circulate. They're not looking for parking. They just they are controlled by a driving management center or traffic management center, and that's a totally different type of mobility compared to a Mercedes S-Class, where people use L4 technology to decide, do I want to drive by myself or do I relax and let the machine do this job? So both options are possible. We believe in both options, but we considered the L5 situation.
Yeah, so I get it, and I agree completely, actually. I guess what I'm wondering, though, wouldn't it be a vastly more attainable, more easy goal, or I should say a less difficult goal, to you know, for cities to embrace level 4, I mean, as soon as possible, right? And just so I'm thinking, for example, just to use Zurich as my favorite example, if you take Bahnhofstrasse, it's already got those beautiful streetcars, yeah? But what if you effectively, instead of the streetcars, you had literally autonomous cars, but only on Bahnhofstrasse and going to, you know, wherever the streetcars go? It's the same idea, right? But it's a more attainable goal, maybe also from a consumer acceptance, right? People are more inclined to get on a car, an autonomous car, which drives only on that street safely in a constrained environment, no?
No, I don't think so, for several reasons. First reason is level 4 is to some extent risky because you have this danger zone when the machine gives over control to human or human gives back control to the machine. That's a dangerous situation. Because imagine you sleep and all of a sudden the machine tells you, now you have 10 seconds to take over control. And in that 10 seconds, you have to watch other cars, you have to watch pedestrians and try to find yourself in this traffic situation all of a sudden, basically. And that's a dangerous situation. So many cities say for this reason, we want to go directly to L5. That means no involvement between machine and human. And I think that's a valid argument. Mm-hmm. And there's another argument for L5. In the world of L5, you think in terms of shared mobility. That means people do not own those pods or those shuttles. And and only shared mobility is able to reduce the amount of vehicles in the street. So if we pursue our existing business model that people purchase cars, we are not able to reduce the amount of cars in the street. So we need to have some sort of sharing concept. And I think L5 is the right environment for implementing sharing connected with autonomous mobility.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And it certainly syncs up with the eventual goal that I guess Elon has talked about for the Tesla fleet, which is the idea that eventually it'll be cost prohibitive to buy a Tesla. And that you will henceforth in a few years supposedly just be Yeah, you won't. You'll never own one. You'll just be sharing one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. This will also drive down mobility costs.
Right, of course.
And Ford does not drive down mobility costs. Mm-hmm.
So, all right. So, should we start picking on specific cities? I mean, like, what would you like? Is there a way to rank sort of cities in terms of what you think are the most likely candidates to sort of jump on this first? I mean, again, my assumption is that so I know that Boston has just been doing a ton of work in this space. Their mayor's office even has like a dedicated autonomous vehicle task force or something like this. And Boston needs it, right? Because Boston roads are pretty funny, to put it politely. And the traffic is a different level of crazy. So I don't know, like, is there any thought on like which cities are going to tackle this sooner?
Yeah, I mean, we also interviewed a couple of people, around 30, from industry, research, and also politicians. And the result is that there are different reasons why we have, or why a country does have, autonomous driving. An example, in America, the need is, or actually the distribution of autonomous driving is basically driven by the technology companies and also by the free market. While in Europe, there is already a very good public transportation existing. So we are here in Europe very carefully by introducing autonomous cars, and it probably takes longer. And there's no actual need as we have in the US, because you obviously have in a lot of cities very poor public transportation systems, which means in the US you are more responsible to introduce the autonomous cars, as an example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's curious. Like, I've often wondered, like, what's the limiting factor in terms of, you know, so I guess, all right, so there's an analogy I've thought about in the past. It just seems like it's, going back to the social element of all this, I mean, when, say, the first iPhone came out or the App Store came out, it was a new technology and it was an easy way to get it to market. And there was no kind of, there was no friction against, you know, there was no resistance to it. Here, I feel like even if the technology is ready, there's still a lot of friction. It's still not an easy thing to get people to embrace. And I think that's one of the big challenges, right? So for example, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I feel like with most new technologies, it's almost a foregone conclusion. If the technology is good, if it works, if it's great, it'll just be the natural way of things for that new technology to supersede the older technology, whether it was the first combustion engine cars replacing horse and carriage, or whether it was trains replacing, I guess, wagons. Right, but I feel like here, even if we have the technology, it's not a foregone conclusion that it's going to happen right away. There has to be a very concerted effort from the municipality side, from the strategic sort of technology company side, and it has to be a real. It's going to require a really solid effort that I feel like we haven't seen with other new technologies. Do you agree that it may just not happen in certain cities?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It takes carrots and sticks. Otherwise, it's impossible to implement this technology. And carrots can be tax reductions, specific lanes for those cars, and sticks might be regulations and specific laws in some circumstances. I absolutely agree. And the reason is that the auto industry did a tremendous job within the last 50 years. They told us nothing is more important than your car, because your car reflects everything. It's self-esteem. Yep. It demonstrates social prestige. It helps you finding the most beautiful girl out there in the streets, and many of those things. And we love cars. We consider cars as partners in our life. And getting rid of all those things, that's a hard job. Going back to the nature of mobility, that's what we are talking about. Entering a pod or a shuttle, driving from A to B, without thinking of social prestige and I'm in love with a car and things like that. However, Mark, the good news is other aspects can come into such a car. For example, advertising. Starbucks is offering a rebate when we jump off and enter the shop, and so new forms of communication can take place and can transfer this boring vehicle into an exciting exciting car.
Absolutely. I mean, personally, yeah, you don't have to convince me. My concern is, how do we convince everybody else? Because that is indeed the big challenge, right?
Yeah, maybe at some point we need to stick.
Well, okay, so let's talk about that. So as a lawyer, one of my biggest fascinations, obviously, with everything happening in the autonomous vehicle space is, well, obviously the legal aspect. It's really fascinating stuff. And so as you're probably well aware, in the US right now, it's pretty much the Wild West. States can generally do what they want. And I've actually suggested that that's great for innovation, obviously, I think, in general, for the time being. However, I think that eventually, once companies are ready to get level 4 cars on the road, and obviously level 5, that eventually we do need a proper, rigorous framework of law in the form of what I've at least hypothetically suggested, an FAVA, a Federal Autonomous Vehicle Administration, to complement the FAA. Mm-hmm. And so to put it more succinctly, I think that for level 1, 2, 3, by all means, do what you want. But once you want to put level 4 and 5 on the roads, it's got to be approved by an FAVA of sorts. What do you think?
Yes.
I mean, like, in other words, are you in favor of that sort of government regulation in all countries generally, like that AVs are sufficiently complex as to require that?
Well, for us in Europe, it's even more important because we cross borders. And so
yeah,
we need international regulations. And mm-hmm. But I'm very, very optimistic that we will get the rules which make sure that we sit in cars which are on a specific technical level. I think the other issue which you raised is more important. How can we get rid of manually driven cars in our streets? And and we need probably at some point regulations that we that, for example, a mayor has the right to say, hey, I only want to see automatic cars in my city. I don't mm-hmm. want to see manually driven cars anymore in the city. I have a parking ground outside the city where all those cars can park, but people have to switch transportation mode and enter autonomous shuttles, for example. I think we need to have these types of regulations and rules. Otherwise, it will be very complicated because mixed traffic is dangerous. Imagine you have 10 autonomous vehicles in the streets, and in this group of 10 vehicles, there's one manually driven car that causes a lot of chaos. So at some point, we have to get rid of those cars.
Yeah, I mean, one could say that, I mean, what's the difference? Certain cities have streets which are pedestrian only. Beyond this point, mm-hmm. you can't drive a car, yeah. you must walk with your feet. So what's the difference? Maybe on these streets you say, well, you can't drive your own car, but you can get in a car which drives you. Mm-hmm. I mean, streets have had limitations for one thing or another forever, right? I mean, and certainly many cities in the world already have restrictions based on the emissions, right? So... Mm-hmm. This is sort of a difference of degree more than a difference of kind, I think, in terms mm-hmm. of further probably, restrictions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, but okay, mm-hmm. let's go back to kind of the focal point of the study, though, right? Because at the end of the day, it comes down to deploying autonomous vehicles are a necessary step in the right direction, but they're obviously not sufficient in the absence of, well, shared mobility. And so, well, obviously, COVID has kind of blown a hole in sharing anything with anybody. So how does this adversely impact, you know, this whole transition. I mean, nobody wants to get into an Uber or a Lyft or anything even remotely shared, let alone public transit of any sort. I know that in San Francisco, for example, the so-called light rail system has now been shut down until next year. So isn't this very bad?
Yeah, I think COVID works in both directions. You're right. Nobody wants to enter a Uber car. We do see that people go back to their own cars. They avoid public transportation. But on the other side, we have a lot of cities opening up new lanes for bikes, for micromobility. And that's a good sign. I see positive signs and also negative signs. You're also right that a lot of manufacturers reduced all programs for autonomous mobility due to the problems in sales. That's definitely right. So we do see some problems concerning the next step in mobility. But at the end of the day, COVID will not stop this transformation.
Right. And actually, you touched on something that I've suggested for a while, which is that you're right. With respect to all the streets being closed to vehicles and being open to pedestrians, certainly some of those streets could be restricted only to level 4 and level 5 vehicle development and testing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you have just one or two streets. Somebody made a clever argument, though, suggesting that the data that an autonomous vehicle would be collecting in such a restricted circumstance wouldn't be very meaningful training data. Mm-hmm. But I suggested certainly it's better than nothing, right?
Right.
Certainly some testing, even with suboptimal data, is better than no testing. I don't know.
And COVID taught us an important lesson. We are able to transform. We do many things differently. We have home office, we have Zoom meetings, we have all those things we never thought before. But it was possible almost from one day to the next. So,
We humans are pretty adaptable, if nothing else. That is true.
That's right. That's absolutely right, yes.
So the question how we get out of this crisis. I mean, we got this, as Andreas said, this pop-up bicycle lane in a couple of cities. And the question now is how we get out. Do we really get back or give back the streets to the cars, or do we keep them as a bicycle lane? So now politicians can ask themselves if they want to go a step further and keep everything, which obviously came out as a good decision or a good point to change, or if they really change it back. So we have it in our hand right now, or at least the politicians, but they really need to use this chance for the future.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it's also good to hear you both acknowledge that indeed there is that big social component, the big consumer acceptance thing. I mean, Max, you certainly know of the study that we've been conducting, I mean, the survey that we've been running, with our firm, right? So I think the more data that we can accumulate on consumer acceptance of autonomous vehicles, the better, right? Because that is going to be crucially important to understand how people are willing to adapt. It's probably worth mentioning to folks listening, if you haven't yet taken the survey, just head over to our website at hogandco.com, check it out. It's a pretty fascinating survey. I mean, you get to learn a lot about yourself also, really, because the questions are pretty in-depth, honestly. But let's see. Okay, so why don't we jump to the end here then? I see you've got four future scenarios that you talk about. So I guess, obviously, depending on the type of archetype city that, you know, in which you've conducted your studies, so obviously different cities will see different kinds of solutions. It looks like you've got shifting from private cars to non-autonomous but still shared, right? You've got another type which is in favor of robo-shuttles, so autonomous shared shuttle pod vehicles. A third type is focusing on micromobility, presumably like scooters and bicycles, I guess. And finally, a thing that you call robopods, which is sort of a mini shared shuttle, literally two passengers maximum, right?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And do you see that, let's see, and is there any kind of rhyme or reason to which kind of cities will be favored by one solution or the other? Is this, again, primarily dictated by the physical design of the city, or does this then tend to be something else which is driving that solution?
So as an example for the high compact middle rate, the autonomous cars doesn't perform that best. And an example for that archetype is Berlin or Vienna. And the reason for that is that we already got there a pretty well existing public transport network. So
right.
That's the reason why it obviously, or autonomous cars are obviously not that good performing, because they would cannibalize the public transport, which means people switch from the public transport to cars, which increase traffic situation. But in other cities, as an example, in car-centric giants, Los Angeles as an example, autonomous mobility would make the traffic situation even better. So as you see, there are traits which are beneficial for autonomous cars and are not.
And this reminds me, I almost forgot to ask you, we're seeing at least anecdotally, but I think also the data is validating the anecdotes, that indeed people are shifting out of cities more to suburbs. And so I guess the question becomes what impact this will have on the testing and certainly the deployment of autonomous vehicles and their role, right? So speaking of anecdotes, one of the things I've heard for quite some time now is that in the UK, people who own Tesla vehicles tend to drive further and more frequently than owners of any other car. And speaking personally, I can say that my wife and I have definitely done much, much, much more driving since we got our Tesla, just because it's about one third the cost if you consider only fuel costs as the metric, but obviously there's also maintenance savings. But even just based on fuel versus electricity, it's about one third to one half the cost. Certainly it's just easier to drive because just offloading a lot of the effort driving in traffic with autopilot, as limited as it may be, it definitely offloads a lot of the effort. And so that kind of at least, you know, frees up, it gives the added optionality to live further away from a city generally, which in turn means that more people, assuming we get back to a world where people do still sometimes need to commute to the city, well, now they're, you know, they don't mind commuting as far. So that's going to also really change the dynamic, right?
Absolutely. And that's a problem. These widely spread neighborhoods reduce the efficiency of autonomous driving.
Right.
Absolutely. Especially when we think about shared autonomous driving. And because shared autonomous driving is most efficient in dense neighborhoods, in dense environments. Sure. And that makes it difficult. Absolutely. So probably the solution is a mix of different types of transportation, different transportation modes. So trains, subways, micro-mobility, as well as shuttles and pods. But that's the answer is not general. So we have to look case-specific into specific cities, into specific environments, which combination of modes makes sense. But you're absolutely right. That's a disadvantage.
And so, I mean, I know it's always the annoyingly impossible question to even discuss, but should we talk about timelines? I mean, what's realistically, you know, what's like a realistic time frame for when we're going to start seeing these sorts of shifts?
I would say that depends on whom you ask.
Yes, it does.
There are some people out there, they say that never will work or happen, but if you ask other people from tech companies, they promise me that we'll have autonomous car on the roads in the next 2 to 3 years. So, I mean, that's a hard bet. But maybe, Andreas, do you know more?
Well, but hang on, though. Even if we have autonomous cars on the roads, again, to the point of your study, that doesn't speak at all to the sharing aspect of it. I mean, so what if there's a lot of autonomous cars? What matters is it a shared mobility application, right?
Well, I'm pretty sure that we will see the first shared autonomous applications I would say in 22, we are in contact with many of those high-tech companies offering those devices and those machines, and all of them are arguing that the negotiations with cities are in a pretty mature phase. So we'll see limited applications in some neighborhoods, or in some quarters, not across the whole cities, but at least on such a level that this combination of different pods and shuttles can replace traditional car-based mobility. I think that we will see in 22 in some of those called smart cities, cities who are very progressive and try to change the nature of mobility substantially.
And I know it's sort of beyond the beyond the scope of the discussion and your research, but it's worth at least asking briefly, since it's a foregone conclusion that future autonomous vehicle development will also be electric, and furthermore, again, to the point of your research, that everything must indeed be shared eventually, which we can all agree on, what are your thoughts on what's going to happen with respect to tax revenue and, say, insurance generally? Like, any thoughts on how that's all going to play out?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that insurance payments will go down, because we know that 91% to 94% of all car accidents are caused by humans and not by the machine. So if the machine takes over driving responsibilities, the amount of accidents should go down significantly. That means that the risk of driving goes down. That means that insurance payments can go down. So the car insurance industry is in big trouble, in my view.
And another point is what concerns the city is a lot of city makes money by parking spaces or traffic toll. So that's a really big loss for the city. So they need to find new business models, how to make money with autonomous cars, because they will lose a big amount of money or income within their city. And even though what we shouldn't forget, if people move out, as you explained, they are able to drive further out of the city, the prices for houses is dropping down. So that totally will destroy or change the financial business industry within the city. So they really need to focus on new business models.
Well, that's a really good point, actually. Although I would imagine that this impact will be much more or less on certain cities, right? So my somewhat naive assumption here is that obviously if you compare a city in which a large percentage of the population already relies on public transit instead of their own vehicle versus, take Paris versus say Los Angeles. I would assume therefore any major shift is going to impact adversely a city like LA much more than it would impact a city like Paris, no?
Yes, probably. But I mean, the city in Paris is already, or should look for new models how to gain money. And then it comes to the question of the mobility platform. This is probably the next billion dollar question within mobility. Who owns all the mobility on demand? And that could be the city itself, but it also could
be Google Maps. Yeah.
So we really need to think who is the fleet provider. And this doesn't matter really if we are talking about autonomous car or if we talk about the micro-mobility scooter. Because currently within the city it's a mess. You need a ton of apps to find the traffic mode you want to find. So yeah, exactly. At the end, you as a city can really take over this mobility platform. And this is a lot of money behind that platform, because at the end, you can decide who can participate within your mobility ecosystem or not. And yeah, city need to question if they really want to own the platform or if they want to give it up to a third party like Google Maps.
I mean, can we theorize on this based on some analogies? I mean, if it was one provider of the vehicle, I would say the analogy, for example, is the police force. I mean, in American cities and certainly in European cities, you get, you know, one primary supplier of vehicles, right? So I think in Germany, a lot of the BMWs are used for police cars and Volkswagen as well, I guess I've seen. And in America, mm-hmm. we tend to have Ford, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, suppose, for instance, yeah, I don't know, take, yeah, suppose that, yeah, Google's Waymo division decided to start producing, started selling these to cities. I mean, that would make sense. The city would still own them, or at least maybe lease them or subscribe to them, essentially, right? Isn't that the same analogy as with, say, police vehicles?
Yeah, we will definitely find those models, those subscription models. But I'm not really concerned about the hardware, because that will be commodity. So the interesting part is the sensoring and the software. And I think it's pretty clear that we will not have 20 suppliers in the market, but we will have 4 or 5. And the market is big enough to have those different concepts or different technologies out there. And we will have kind of an oligopolistic market for software, for processing unit, for sensoring. And maybe the hardware business could be at the end a simple commodity business, especially when we talk about pods and shuttles. These vehicles are on the streets at a max speed of whatever, 20-30 miles per hour. So that's no rocket science to produce those cars. Mm-hmm. And that's simply a economies of scale business. But the crucial point is, do we have enough competition on the software side? And I'm very confident on that, because if we compare Mobileye with Tesla, with Google, we do see different approaches. And I think there's sure. room for all of those approaches out there.
Mm-hmm. And also, let's face it, I mean, maybe it seems like there could be a very real need to give sufficient incentives to cities. I mean, at the very least, you're right, there's a concern that they could lose a lot of revenue from parking slots. On the other hand, you look at companies like HERE Technologies, which are basically crowdsourcing all these, the various data from vehicles, and they're able to sell the road data back to the cities. So the cities know how to, you know, they know which part of the road has to be repaired. And so that saves a lot of money. Instead of randomly looking around, they can go exactly to the, you know, the precise location. I mean, maybe that's what it comes down to. If they can actually utilize the sort of data, maybe it's more than just cutting down on traffic, but indeed at the end of the day, use that data to in totally new mm-hmm. ways. That's what it comes down to, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a story which we hear all the time. Data is a new gold standard, basically.
Yeah, of course.
but at the end of the day, we need to make sense out of this data. And I think that's still a long way to go. There's a lot of data around, but not many companies are really able to make sense of data. But I agree, especially when you think of Google having all information about the passengers, navigation data, surfing data coming from internet activities and things like that. And if we combine this data with a pretty clear understanding of the personality of the passengers, that's right. But then business models come into play. So what kind of business model can be implemented? And that's a tricky question. So transforming data into business model. Data per se is useless. So we need to learn something in order to improve our offers, our services, and things like that. And that's a transformation process which is not that easy. At least the car manufacturers are not at all successful in doing those things, because they know have a ton of data. They know a lot of about us, but I haven't seen much services or specific offers coming from them in order to increase sales. But we'll see. Maybe Google and Netflix and Amazon, these companies are much smarter when it comes to data compared to the traditional car manufacturers.
Well, yeah, I suppose on that note, then we should say to be continued. It's been really awesome talking to both of you. I mean, with respect for your time, I know we're at the top of the hour, but yeah, Andreas, Max, it's been great. I mean, like I said, it was super exciting to hear where you guys have taken this study from the first version that I saw a few years ago. So yeah, really great stuff. So thank you both very much indeed. And obviously I encourage you, well, Max, we're always in touch anyway, but Andreas, obviously please do keep in touch as well.
Oh yeah, it was a pleasure having met you.
Yeah, likewise. Well, I'll let you both know next time I make it out to Europe, hopefully sooner rather than later, and it'd be great to meet up.
Yeah, hopefully we'll have you here in Switzerland.
I would love nothing
pleasure
more.
Hosting you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you,
Mark. Guys. Well, look, yeah, have a wonderful evening over there, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. Great, bye-bye. Okay.
Thank you, bye-bye, Mark. Take care, bye-bye.